All right, welcome to Sunday Letters. It's Larry Maguire, Dmitry Belikov, to my left here, if you're watching on YouTube or other platform. Welcome to Sunday Letters podcast. We're talking about work, the human relationship with work, the pursuit of happiness in work, the challenges of work, and so on. And today's no different. Just a quick note before we launch into the conversation this week, which is essentially why work, why do we work, the philosophical perspective on work. A couple of things to note, all of this content that we create is free, free to consume, most of it at least. The archive is locked down for our subscribers. If you want to get access to that, and if you want to support the work that we're doing, consider becoming a paid subscriber. There's a link in the notes below this video and also in the podcast episode, wherever you happen to be listening, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon. You should find a link to become a paid subscriber. You can subscribe for free, of course. And if you prefer not to become a paid subscriber, you can throw us a tip for a fiver or any amount you want. You'll also find that link at the bottom of the show notes there on the podcast and also on YouTube. So we greatly appreciate your support. Because all of this work, when we produce this content here, there's a load of hours that are required in the build-up to it. So we enjoy doing this stuff. We enjoy talking about this stuff. We'd like to share this view with you. For those of you who might be disgruntled and otherwise displaced from the abrasiveness of the work that we're asked to do, the workplace and the necessity of it. And sometimes we rail against it. Most of the time we accept that this is just simply life. And that kind of prompts these conversations. And particularly today, we're talking about why work? Why do we bother? What is it about? What is it? Is it a cultural thing? Is it a basic human need to go to work? But the problem here in all of this is that there seems to be an absence of meaning and purpose in it for a lot of people, depending on what research you consume or access. It can range anywhere from between 30% of those surveyed up to 50% and even higher of people are dissatisfied with work. Maybe they enjoy the technicalities of it, the actual work itself, the intrinsics of the work, but there's so many other things that are going on, the extrinsics of it, that bend us out of shape and make us sick. And I don't think that's a stretch. I think it's true for a lot of people. So, Dmitry, we've been talking in the run-up to today, and you penned a brief article on the topic of why work, taking a philosophical perspective on work. So what's the story here? Why do we go to work, apart from the obvious?
Yeah, well, as we talked about already, and I wrote this brief essay. It's largely expository essay, brief. And it's based on a paper of one of the Sean Sayers. Basically, he compares two views in philosophy. Well, one view is so-called instrumental view of work, which means that people see the work and it kind of permeates traditional philosophies as well. Yeah. Some of traditional philosophies as well. The work is seen as just a toil, unpleasant toil. It has to be done, but if we had an opportunity not to do this, we would rather avoid it. And so, at the opposite side of this argument,
in other words, it's done for its objective purpose.
Yeah, just as a means to an end. Yeah,
means
just
to an end. All right. And to what end are we talking about? It's just to make money, to live.
Well, yeah, you can translate it in contemporary world to meet your basic needs. Yeah. To get paid, basically. Mm. That's what it means. So, and yes, apart from that, there is no reason for doing this. This is not in our human nature. In fact, I suppose even John Locke says that it's against even our nature. So given the time and opportunity, we'll just avoid doing that. Mm-hmm. Avoid this useless toil.
And so what do we, if we don't do it, then what do we, what do we do? Or we just lie about the place and become the bourgeoisie then? Is that the story? Or?
Yes, but you see, for them, and probably it's the for their opponent, which we will talk next, which we'll talk about next, they consider the power that is fully human, this power consist in our ability to reason, you know, to think about, you know, logically engaged with something, you know, to argue, to make judgments, and all our creativity kind of is on the mental plane, on psychological, not physical. Like, and then the Sayers talks about the Marx view, which is rather opposite view. And Marx suggests that no, that the work is our human nature, it's in our blood, so we can't just do nothing. We have to produce something, create something, even physical. It's not just in our imagination, but also relates to physical realm, so to speak. And yeah, and for him, what is weird, that he doesn't deny, in a sense, that contemporary work is seen through this lens of instrumental view, you know, that many people consider this work to be just absurd, you know, just a toil, just a burden for them. But it's not something that inherent in work per se. It's just something that contemporary socio-economic environment made up, you know. And he uses this term, what he calls alienation. So in sense, we alienated from our work. So and that creates that feeling that we feel that the job is basically a burden for us.
So there's a distinction here between, let's say, the work that any person would do in a large corporation, in an office somewhere, versus an artist or an artisan creating something like, I don't know, running a bakery and doing that every day and baking bread for the local community, and they all come and they buy bread. That's distinct. Yeah. That type of work is distinct from the soulless, vacuous work that most people do going to work for an organization, I take it then.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, probably the example with bakery is the most salient, because, you know, of course, in the Marx worldview, is, as far as I know, I'm not an expert at Marx, of course, but as far as I know, in his, this idea of alienation lies, of course, the view on division of labor. He is against it, in a sense. And so, if as you mentioned, the bakery. So here you can see how alienation manifests itself. Well, rather, doesn't manifest itself. Because in a bakery, you are responsible for your process. You kind of express your creativity in the process. You're responsible from point A to point B for all modification of the product, in a sense. What you do with that, you
know? Got your hands in it as well.
There's
a connection between the human being, a physical connection between them and what's going on in their mind and their psychic experience.
Yes. And so, of course, when you engage in this process, you know what you need to do. You kind of imagine how your end product gonna look like, and you kind of have this connection with this product, in a sense. So, and if you look at the factories, for example, where the labor is specialized narrowly, you don't have it, actually. All the processes are commanded by people, so you don't have a say in it. So you just set what to do. And also, you probably don't have any idea what the end product is in the end. So you kind of alienated from this process. You just stand there and doing your part, which doesn't have any meaning to you at all.
And so someone else decides what ingredients go into the bread. They decide what the bread looks like. Decide how. Yes. And in fact, there's a machine, but there's a machine does all the work, and you're just standing there pressing a button, right?
Exactly. Right. So basically, it's not of you doing, crudely speaking. So you're just there as a part of the said machine, you know. And but Marx said that we want this satisfying, fulfilling feeling to participate in the process from the beginning to the end, to be the origin of this creation, you know, from the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
And not just a part of it, somewhere in between. And so we have this creative forces that even if we stay without work, if we these forces will still will try to push you to express themselves.
Yeah, so they need expression, or we need to.
Yeah, they need expression. So it's in our nature to throw it there in the environment, in a sense, you know, to manipulate the environment, to transform it in some sense. Yeah, so in a nutshell, this is his opposition to that instrumental view that I was talking about previously. And of course, you can. There is an in between this in between his two thoughts of the self, this creativity, which is basically in all of us, and also he says that the work provides us with the source of self-realization.
Mm-hmm.
And what it means is like, well, it's basically, yeah, the part of creativity, but in a sense that if we create something in this world, we kind of embody ourselves in this product. So in a sense, this product is looked upon as our second self, you know what I mean? So
an expression of who we are.
And
there's no greater illustration of that than maybe to see what a musician or a songwriter or a poet or an artist or someone who's maybe booking the mainstream, so to speak, in terms of work, they're doing their own thing.
Yeah, exactly. And Marx, of course, mentioned that this is not only within the economic, you know, environment. Exactly as you said, it's directly concerns this artistic creations. I mean, like paints, pictures, photographs, everything creative, like music. Well, art.
And sport as well. I mean, it's interesting, you know, you hear just from reading articles on sport and performance and so on, which is another area that I'm interested in, that the number of people, especially kids, lose the enthusiasm and the love of the game, so to speak, when they're asked to perform on spec. They're asked to perform on call for the winning of a medal or of a tournament or whatever it happens to be. It takes the actual, it's kind of the cart before the horse. So there's almost an ulterior motive to actually doing the work or the sport or whatever it happens to be than maybe what gave birth to it in the first place, which was a personal interest and a curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that kind of intrinsic motivation to engage in something that matters most, that in fact is the cause of the making something that's subsequently valuable to other people. And maybe it's the case that when the production of the bread or the music or the sport or whatever happens to be, when that's done because a corporation wants to monetize it and make money from it, well, then you're basically ruining, destroying the process. The whole creative process is compromised.
Yeah. It seems like this, yeah. Also, it's interesting. I didn't mention it in my essay. It was kind of not directly relevant, but it's interesting how Marx sees this interaction between us and nature, you know. And in a sense, he said, like, this work, the work itself, it kind of estranges us from the nature, makes us a separate entity. And at the same time, it unites us, you know, with the nature, mm-hmm. and it's kind of dual process. So you kind of estrange from this world as soon as you start to shape it according to your needs. So you just make out of something natural for us humans, in a sense, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then you kind of unite with the nature, because what you're doing is kind of make you feel like you're at home, you know. All this object is basically your second self, you know, and you kind of feel fine and nice within this nature. And so that was an interesting point also. So yeah.
And so if it's a case that someone and a large swathes of people are become alienated from the actual product of their work, through this systemization and the application or the pursuit of the end result for the sake of money, for example, or some other ulterior motive, it's not just a sense of I don't feel like I'm producing anything of value, but it's almost like there's a split self. It's that you have no. It's that your whole existence almost becomes meaningless. And why so many people feel, use the word that you use, alienated in their work and dissatisfied. And oftentimes, you know, when you see a McDonald's employee dropping a burger on the ground, picking it up and putting it back into the Bundy and wrapping it up, putting it on the shelf, that you say, oh, that's some bad bastard there, sack them. Well, really, that's just, you could say it's a sign of this alienation that you have that you've just spoken about.
Yeah, he just doesn't care about the product. Well, in this situation, the burger, he just doesn't care. It's not of his creation.
That the job has done it to him.
Yeah, it's job. Yeah.
And you talk about when you put people in those situations and they're let's say in a consumerist society like ours, where consumers are led to believe that all their demands are legitimate. And so they don't get the pair of shoes that they expected, or there's some flaw in the shoes or whatever it is, and they come back and they're irate with the sales assistant in the shop. And they're jumping up and down and banging on the table, and they're rude and they're abusive to the sales assistant. And the sales assistant has to maintain a smile, you know, and put on a show, this surface level display. Irving Goffman talked about this surface level acting as opposed to that deeper, more genuine connection and expression of yourself when you're actually making something of value and worth to somebody else. But most of us, certainly in those retail professions, would be putting on a smile and pretending, you know, to be understanding and so on. Undergoing this emotional labor, as it's referred to, and then subsequently feel exhausted and burnt out after a very short time in this type of work. I don't think it's any wonder, you know, that people are feeling the way they are with how we work today.
And you know, sometimes I remember I behave myself probably in the same manner, you know, when you, for example, have a huge line, you know, you go through the, you know, checkout in the grocery store, and you're trying to blame the cashier, basically the worker, for doing it slow. But then you realize, like, you know, if you take a minute, that in what condition does she or he work, you know?
Yeah.
And you can understand, and you become more, you know, calm, you know, more understanding, you know, to her situation or to his situation, whatever. Because they basically work for a minimum wage in most cases, and they would happily, you know, avoid this type of job, you know, I'm sure, but they have to work, and there is no point to be.
So we're making a distinction. Yeah. So when why do we work? Are we compelled to work through a fundamental aspect of our human nature, or are we compelled to work by some extrinsic demand, i.e., the capitalist system of work? Are we commanded to work by the systems that we've constructed in society? Just commanded to work at something in order to be productive. Yeah. It seems to be these two things going on.
You see, this is a question, because I suppose it works differently for many people. Well, for some people, for sure. Because for me, it's, of course, I can't work. I can't do the work, which is burdensome. Like, just to go there and get my payment, it depresses me. But some people I talk in my previous job, they were pretty okay with that. They said, like, listen, we are happy. We are told what to do. We don't know if we are left on our own, we don't know what to do. So we better stay here. We are shown what to do. We get our wage. We go home. We are fine. So some people accept it somehow. I don't know. Probably they still have some inner struggle, you know, at night or during the evening when they're alone home.
And do you think this has they just given up, or you're just trained to think that way, or what?
Well, it could be. I mean, as we talked probably previously, remember I told you about the cognitive dissonance. Probably some people just give up on the whole idea to break free from these shackles, you know, of the employment and burdensome job, you know. And so in a sense, if you work like 10 years, you probably in the beginning, like probably 2 years later, you start to dislike it. But then as years pass by, 7 years, let's say, you're already asking yourself, like, well, what am I doing here? I hated this job, right? But then you, well, but if I hate this job, why, how come I spent so many years here? So that means I don't hate it. I love it, actually. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. So it's kind of, you know, inner trickery of our brains, you know. So, and they probably even start to like it. I mean, they are fine with that.
Even those who are imprisoned will eventually begin to love their masters. What is it? The Stockholm syndrome? Is that what you call it?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So it depends, you know. So to whom this to whom you talk. Some people say, like myself, like I would prefer to do something myself. Although, as I mentioned in the essay, so some people are afraid to take a risk. Perhaps I'm pretty scared to take a risk. I don't know what lies there, but I'm willing to try it.
Sure, who knows?
Go with it.
Maybe a parallel conversation we can have on this is our old concept of time. So risk, a sense of risk implies an understanding of time in a linear sense, at least the existence of tomorrow or next week.
Well,
or
yeah,
next
of course.
Month. Because if we didn't have this concept of there is a next week or tomorrow, or next week or next month or next year, there would be no risk. Or would be, well, to me, it seems that there would be no risk. That if we were present enough to say, well, this feels like a good idea, so why don't I just do it? There's no decision to be made. You just do it, right? Like a child, like a three-year-old. A three-year-old has no concept of tomorrow, or next week, next year. Mm-hmm. A three-year-old just sees something and goes, yeah, that looks good. That looks cool. What's this taste like? And puts it in their mouth, or a two-year-old. So an infant has no hasn't developed these concepts that we take for granted now. And so risk doesn't exist. Well, maybe that's a lie. Okay, I remember when there's a video my wife has of my daughter. She's 11 now. But when she was two, there's this bench we have in the kitchen, the bench for at the kitchen table. And it's we sit on it at the table. But when Cara was small, her legs were too short to reach the floor, obviously. So she turned around on her belly to get down off this bench, and she couldn't, her feet wouldn't reach the floor, and she was in a panic, and she was like and my wife had the camera, and she's trying to encourage her to put her feet on the floor, and she's like, it's okay, Cara, come on. She's in a minor, like mini panic, and eventually she nudges, and eventually her toes touch the floor and everything is great. All right, so maybe there is some sense of risk amongst children, but not in the same way we anticipate risk, the risk of leaving a job. We have all these thoughts around, well, if I leave here, I'll have no income and then I won't survive. Well, maybe that's rational. Maybe that's a rational way to think, because how we've constructed things in this society of ours is that if you don't earn a living, you're just a bum. You don't even deserve a place to live because you need money to pay rent or to repay a mortgage. And if you can't meet those demands, well, then you apply to the local social services and maybe they put you up in a hotel, right? Mm-hmm. And that's no existence. And so brings me on to something that we've mentioned before in our conversations is this ludicrous situation where we have to earn the right to live, at least in a very in a simple, comfortable way. And if you don't work and you don't have a job, well then screw you, tough shit. That's a fucked up situation in my opinion. Where am I going with this? Okay, so it's the risk. You mentioned risk. Do I risk it and go out on my own, or do I risk it and try something new? Well, I contend, and I wrote about this on Tuesday, that we're conditioned to think this way. Conditioned through the family, what we learn from our own upbringing, and also from our broader connections in our local communities and through the media and through school, is that in order to do well, in order to do well, it's not only do well, it's actually survive. You've got to make yourself employable. Yeah. And this is the drive. We're not educated to become self-employed. We're educated to become employed. And that's the whole conveyor belt of education and employment and work, contemporary work. Yeah. You must be employable or else forget it. So, Larry, Dimitri, if you want to make enough to pay your bills and look after your family and so on, well, you've got to get a job. I tried it as well.
Yeah.
I've tried to work for other people. It's impossible. I just don't fit in. I am unemployable, and that's the truth. Now, I'm employable to the extent where I can work with other people, and I often do on projects, and I enjoy that because I'm my own man, I'm a free agent, and I can design those projects however I feel is appropriate. And then I'll meet the criteria, we'll agree, I'm doing a job for you, I'm delivering a program for you or something like that. And you say, well, I need it for 20 people, we need it over 6 weeks, and we need it to hit on these points here. And I go, no problem. And I go off and design it and say, here you are. Let's give this a bash. And then we go for it. So it's a collaborative approach rather than it's flat.
Yeah.
So I get to be creative. I get to, within certain boundaries, there's structures. We all need structure. Without structure, we disappear. We would be obliterated, and we wouldn't even be atoms in the universe, because everything needs a structure. So structure is fundamental to our whole existence. All right, so there's a bit of structure there. Decide how to do it, put it together. But it's collaborative and it's flat. But in the workplace, the one that Marx would rail against, that workplace is hierarchical and dictatorial. You come in, Dimitri, and you do as I want you to do. Now, you do as you're told. You take your breaks when I tell you to take your breaks. You're only entitled to a couple of holidays a year. Right, 4 weeks a year. So I dictate terms to you. And I might dress that up and I might say, now here's what your entitlements are, and you know, and you'll have all this and you'll have all that and you'll have all the other. And that'll be great. And we dress it all up and we use nice language. But really, it's about you coming in and complying with the rules of how we work, because yeah, we say so, because we're the boss.
Yeah.
And so
I would probably add to that. And that's basically all you need to do, just to adhere to ideology and do what they said, and you will get the promotion rather quickly.
Even if you're at your job, you'll get a promotion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you don't have to have any special talents.
Yeah, once you're compliant.
Yeah, once you go by the book, by the rule book, you're fine.
Yeah,
I couldn't do that. That's why I wasn't promoted.
Yeah, who's your brother? something you were talking about earlier on, and you wrote about in your essay, you touched on it, was Hegel's dialectics, and how the nature of reality and human relations and existence is about this dialectical relationship, this master-slave kind of setup. That's applicable to the work. I suppose it's a great example of how that operates in the workplace, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, mostly why I included this Hegel quote there is to kind of illustrate how the self-realization works. I mean, for me, I think it was pretty precise and elaborate on his part to say how he sees how we interact, how we shape this object, and how we embody ourselves in this object, in a sense. Yeah.
And I suppose there's a risk there as well. And one I've kind of come up against myself, and we have to be wary of it, if we do decide to buck the trend and work for ourselves and do our own thing, is that we don't become too much invested in the thing that we make. Because, well, first of all, the obvious thing is it's not us. It might be a reflection of us in a particular time we were alive or whatever. But when you read artists and writers, write about their processes, some of the more successful ones, they'll write about how Mick Jagger with the Rolling Stones as an example. So I'm not concerned about what I wrote about in 1965 or 67. That's gone. That's like, so what? I'm interested in doing what I'm doing now. And people kind of go, oh, this was such a great album, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, well, yeah, so what? It's like, I want to play the stuff that we're making now, not what I made 30, 40 years ago or whatever, 50 years ago. And also writers will talk about books that they've written and how it's their baby, but they realize that they have to let it go and get it published and then move on to the next project. And there's a little piece in a minute, but when we become too closely tied to the thing that we make, we can become oversensitive and even damaged by, let's say, criticism. And, you know, critics don't like the music we made or the book that we wrote, and all of a sudden we're destroyed. So we're too invested in it almost, you know? And so that's the risk when we're doing our own thing, is to be able to say, well, that's that, and I'm me, and there's a difference between the two. And I know the feeling of being too heavily invested in something, because when in 2010, when that business failed, I was destroyed because the business was me and I was the business, and I didn't have a separation between the two. Couldn't separate the man from the music, so to speak, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's really important, because if you can't do that, you're kind of leaving yourself open to all kinds of, criticism and anything. If it doesn't work out, it's like you're wiped out. Well, I'm not trying that again because it didn't work last time, you know?
Yeah.
So if we weren't going to work, what the hell are we going to do with our time?
Well, look at us. What are we doing now? we enjoy our creativity, doing content for this channel, and I pretty much enjoy it, because the last few days I just wake up and I started to read something and to write, and at some stage I look at the clock and it's like probably 5 hours gone.
Yeah.
And I was just, what the hell?
What happened there?
I didn't have any lunch at all. But I compare myself being employed, where I was watching at the clock like every 5 minutes, like, praying to God, like, come on, where's the end of the shift?
Torment.
Yeah, torment. So that's just brief comparison, you know. So that's what we do. I mean, I was unemployed now for 4 months since my last job, and you kind of want to do something. You can't just sit there. You need to do something. Whether it's reading, writing, doesn't matter. You have to do this. And I suppose if it can bring some profit, it will bring double pleasure, you know, in a sense.
So, I mean, the wealthiest in society seem to find plenty of things to do with their time.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody thinks about them. They basically unemployed. They have the status, I suppose.
Yeah.
We can't say that they spend their daytime from 9 to 5, well, just working the narrowly specialized job, you know. And I don't think so. I don't believe so. Probably, well, I can't say that for sure. I've never been there, but it's kind of my feeling.
Or if we manage to master the art of manipulation and get 1,000 or 5,000 or 20,000 people to do the work. Now, it's no simple task to build an organization, a corporation with that many people. And it's a testament to the people who do that, that those businesses are successful. But at the same time, there's a squeezing of the people who perform that work, whose work it is, allows those massive profits to be built. And so I don't understand why as a society we've made it okay for all of that surplus. And this is what Marx was talking about 100, 200 years ago, whenever he wrote Capital. When did he write it? I have a copy over here, look. the original publication. I don't know when the original one was. Maybe you know. I can't say. I'm no Marx expert myself. But anyway, he railed against the idea that the surplus that workers, the surplus of what workers produce, the difference between what they made in wages and so on, versus what the product or products were sold for, was basically pooled and collected for the elite. And slavery was a big part of why the wealthiest countries in the world today became wealthy in the first place, and the manipulation and coercion and abuse of Africans and Irish and all the minorities, and not only I'm going off topic now, but not only those minority groups, but it was anyone who wasn't white and European and male was abused and misused and mistreated and manipulated and coerced and shot and sent off on ships around the world to work in cotton fields and develop new colonies around the world. That's what happened. That's what happened to the Irish. That's what happened to the Africans. That's what happened to the Aboriginal Australians. That's what happened ethnic groups all over the planet. India, China, you go anywhere that the colonial forces in the world went, and people were abused and misused and mistreated, and their wealth extracted and stolen from them. That's why Britain are as wealthy as they are. That's why the United States are as wealthy as they are. So it's nothing new. And Marx was writing about this a couple of hundred years ago, how the ordinary everyday workers, the man on the street, the man and woman on the street, were taken advantage of, and that surplus wealth taken. It's an insane situation to me that we have that still today, knowing what we know. I think it's as much a reflection of the abuse that the capitalists dish out as it is a reflection of our own willingness to be abused as working people, you know?
Well, that's what I'm saying, because, you know, this situation, I suppose, existed throughout history. I mean, even Friedrich Nietzsche says about it with his slave and master morality. There were always two classes, were masters and slaves. Mm. And you can do basically nothing with that. Just walk off this system and that's it. But of course, how to do it, nobody knows, I suppose.
But, and then you get tired, like the French did and the revolution. You get tired of the wealthy classes doing nothing and pooling all this wealth. And then you have a revolution, and then revolutionaries become dictators. And then we have the same situation again, and we capitulate to these small group of people. It's insane to me that we have a situation where one person, and it's usually a man or a woman masquerading as a man, is set up to be the leader and tell everyone else what to do. I think it's a crazy, crazy situation. It's not unique to now, I don't think, but there are other cultures down through history who made decisions for the social group based on a collective model rather than an individualistic leader, the cult of leadership, you know, the cult of the personality. I think that's a lot got to do with it. Where am I going with this? I started on something, but I'm after going on sidetrack now, talking about Hegel. Anyway, I forget where I was, but
no worries. We'll get there.
There has to be an alternative to how we currently organize ourselves and get things done and go to work.
Yeah, but there seems to me this kind of dilemma, because we feel, like many people feel, that something has to be changed, but nobody knows what it is, you know, how to change it. And on the other spectrum, I suppose there is those who doesn't want things to be changed, you know? And so these two point of view, like two groups of people, one, they don't know how to change anything, and the other, that doesn't want anything to change, they kind of converge. And in reality, we see no change and the same state of affairs, you know?
Yeah.
And I suppose we have to somehow come up with some sort of solution, at least speculate about it, but yeah.
Chomsky wrote and spoke about anarcho-syndicalism as a means to organize ourselves in a more efficient and fair manner, in that we have smaller groups, smaller individual groups who collaborate together in order to get things done. Now, we might do an episode on that topic, because I suppose an extension of anarchism, which is essentially looks for deregulation. You say the word anarchism, most people think that it's crazed mob of youths throwing petrol bombs in the street, when really that's not what it is at all. And we might get talking about that in a future episode, and maybe anarcho-syndicalism is a part of that conversation.
Yeah, we can. Yeah, sure. It's going to be an interesting topic, yeah.
I think so. But you could say, well, the whole effort, the collective effort to change things hasn't worked, and it won't work, because really what it boils down to is you making a change for you and me making a change for me and everyone else doing the same thing. And following our own curiosities and interests and building something based on that. I mean, why do we have to be part of a big organization? Why can't we just build a business of one and work to earn enough to mind ourselves and our families and eat and live well? Why do we need to employ other people and make money off them? Why is that necessary to be a legitimate business? I don't believe it is necessary, you know?
Yeah, so this is something to explore next episode,
okay,
for sure.
Have we answered the question, though, today?
Well, that's the question that probably don't have a straight answer, you know, to this. It's just something to speculate about, to think about, probably.
Yeah.
But there will be no definite answer, for sure, I suppose.
So why do we work? Well, there's an innate need to be active, to do things. We're not born to be stones at the side of the road.
But on the other hand, we don't want to do the job that is, well, that is widespread in our contemporary society, you know.
But if we were left to our own devices, would we find something?
I suppose, yes.
Mm. And if we weren't compromised by how we've structured society and the workplace, by all of those ideas, the primary one being, I have to educate myself, I have to dress in a particular way, I have to fulfill this particular ideal, I have to be employable in order to live and exist and do well, so to speak. That's not of our own design. That's somebody else's.
Yeah, and you know, like, if you look at the people now, you know, if you probably yourself have a garden, you know, back in the backyard.
Very small, so, it's about that size.
Yeah. So my sister, for example, they spend like a lot of time. They have weekends. They always work at this garden. So I suppose if they wouldn't work doing their job, daily job, you know, in the office, wherever they work, they would just grow something, you know.
Yeah,
just try to arrange their garden, you know, to move plants around and, you know, just doing this kind of stuff, and they wouldn't just sit watch Netflix, for sure, you know.
Yeah, or if
no offense to Netflix, but
if their survival was dependent on cultivating lettuce and carrots and onions and potatoes, and maybe they do already.
Yeah.
But if you were growing veg in your garden and you were involved in that process and you fed yourself that way, and then you solve the surplus, I mean, that's idyllic to me. It might be naive, but it seems to me like a worthwhile pursuit to do something like that.
It is. And you know, if you, some people also say, you know, that the place, your place of work, is kind of includes your social, you know, interaction as well. So you go to work because you can talk to people, socialize, in a sense. But if you look at that from the different angle, well, it's the only circle, because everybody work, you know. If they stay home, let's say, and for example, my neighbor has a garden, I'm having a garden, we nearly really we will interact with each other. Yeah. So this lack of work wouldn't be even relevant, you know.
Yeah, and that's a good point, right? Because I read briefly, I've leafed through, you're familiar with Gallup, they're an agency, they do surveys and stuff.
I heard something, but yeah, the name is familiar,
Gallup, they're an international organization and they survey, in this particular survey, it was happiness at work, right? So their 2023 it's not called a happiness at work, it's called the state of the workplace or something like that, report. 23% of people surveyed globally said they were reported to be fully engaged in their work. 56% said they were dissatisfied with work. 56% of people.
Yeah.
When you read some of the quotes that were taken, I remember one sticks out. This respondent said something like, I can find it now, I have the PDF. I enjoy the work, something like this anyway. I enjoy the work because I socialize with my workmates. We drink together, we go out together, we engage with each other outside work. So I really value my work. But he could have that equally without work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's my point.
So the requirement to work and to labor and to go there from 9 to 5, 5 days a week, or sometimes more, doesn't predicate you forming meaningful relationships with other human beings.
Yeah.
It's a consequence, a natural consequence of being human.
But yeah, exactly.
It's not decided upon based on whether you have a job or not. So I think people confuse that and are reluctant to leave their jobs because of their friends, you know?
Yeah. That's what basically my point is, yeah. So it's kind of reverse thinking, I don't know, like just false argument there in a sense. So
yeah,
it's better to work because we have social interaction. So people will find this interaction. If nobody works, well, hey, we have time, we have everybody staying home, you know, they would gladly interact with you, I'm sure. It's not about work at all.
Yeah, and others would argue that human beings are by our nature cooperative, not competitive. And the marketplace, the workplace, within the capitalist system builds in competition as a necessary component. Well, it's competitive for us, but not competitive to those at the top, because it just becomes one large conglomerate who seeks to extract as much as they can from the environment, subsequently destroying it, and also from people. And if left to our own devices, as the argument goes, human beings would cooperate and look after each other. And that's what we are inclined to do. And we're inclined to seek that out, in fact, when we're not working, through volunteering, through working on, I don't know, things like software or music or whatever happens to be, for no pay, like what we're doing here. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's my contention is, and maybe I'll write a paper on this at some stage, is that the workplace is a fake plastic environment that makes people sick psychologically, emotionally, physiologically. And until we cop ourselves on and realize that, and not only is it making us sick, it's making the planet sick, pollution everywhere. And all this initiative for this Green New Deal that we're talking about in the States and globally and COP20 or whatever it is, 29 or whatever the hell they call themselves, these initiatives, the environmental initiatives to reduce the production and consumption of fossil fuels is a nonsense. It's a marketing exercise. Do you know what I mean? And so it all feeds in. It's all, and David Graeber wrote about this as well, is we're destroying the planet with all these jobs. We need to stop working. You know?
Well, yeah, but I think we're going to leave this for... actually, it's a good topic for the some of the episodes, the cooperative nature versus competitive nature, something like that.
And I know I have one particular source that I can delve into for that one. I can't think of his name, but I've followed this stuff on followed this stuff on YouTube. So we don't have an answer, sorry, folks, to this question. But
I think the pretty intuitively the answer is one, just We would like to avoid this work. We don't have to do this work in this particular state of affairs, like that we have to do it just because we need to make living. But yeah, if we are left on our own devices, we would manage to do something.
We would do all right, you know?
Yeah, to do something creative, interact, to produce something of value, you know, for society.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for that discussion. Dimitri's article is out today, Thursday, the day of recording, Thursday the 18th. So give that a read. Thanks for listening or watching, if you're watching this video on YouTube or some other platform. Thanks for being a part of it. Thanks for supporting us with your attention and your time. If you'd like to support us in a financial way, you can. It's €5 a month, or there's a few deals going around Substack. You can pick it up for €4 a month or €40 a year, which is a better deal again. It works out about $3.50 or €3.50 a month. And your contribution helps us kind of pay bills and pay for platforms and helps us do what we're doing. And it shows that maybe you value what we're doing as well, which is great. So if you don't fancy becoming a paid subscriber, you can make a one-off tip. There's a link below in the description, and that would be greatly appreciated. So sundayletters.substack.com is where you'll get this material. Thanks for listening in. Thanks, Dimitri, for...
Thank you, Larry, for inviting me.
Today. We'll be back next week with another episode available on all podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon, Pocket Casts, anywhere you get your podcasts, you'll find this show. So thanks, everyone, for listening in, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
All the best.